You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. And today, we take you to a park. A park at the corner of Whittier Boulevard and Dittman Avenue. A full square block of open air, sunshine, and trees just north of the 5 freeway. Now, 50 years ago, this place, Laguna Park, was the destination for 30,000 marching people, mostly Chicanos, who made history here at this park. They turned out on August 29, 1970, for the Chicano Moratorium. Moratorium because they wanted to stop the disproportionate number of Latinos dying on the front lines in the Vietnam War. But the three-mile Chicano Moratorium March wasn't just about the war. People came from as far away as Texas and New Mexico and New York to also protest substandard education and racism and police violence.
It was a beautiful day weather-wise. The crowds were amazing.
Tong the Elder Gloria Arellanos was a member of the Chicano activist group the Brown Berets. She was one of the moratorium organizers.
People were happy. You know, it was a positive thing. People coming out of the stores. There was little danzantes, young children doing, you know, some dancing, very beautiful dancing, music.
Rosalia Munoz is another Chicano moratorium organizer.
It was a wondrous event. It was like a moving fiesta down the main commercial center of East Los Angeles.
And there was something going on that made me go up on the stage to see what is going on. And all I could see at the back of the park was like a wave. People just coming in and then moving out and then coming back again. And then all hell broke loose.
What started out as a peaceful demonstration of students and families ended with an attack on the crowd by riot-clad police, 400 arrests, and the deaths of four people. One of those killed was Los Angeles Times reporter Ruben Salazar. The events that day became a turning point in the Chicano civil rights movement and left a stain on Los Angeles that after a half century still hasn't gone away. Reporter Monica Lopez has this remembrance.
L.A. was a very different place in 1970. For one thing, Latinos, mostly Mexican-Americans, made up only about 13% of the city's population. Today, it's about half. And at the time, most Mexican-American political power came not from elected officials, but from activism, like the East L.A. student walkouts of 1968. Here's how Rosalio Munoz remembers it.
The farm workers were organizing farm workers. The leaders of walkouts for a higher, better education, they were fighting for better education. The ones fighting for against gerrymandering and to register voters, they were doing that. But we needed people that would focus on organizing against the war and nationally.
The day of the Chicano moratorium, local and national media turned out to cover it, including LA Times reporter Ruben Salazar and documentary filmmaker Jesus Treviño.
On August 29th, I was an associate producer at television station KCET in Los Angeles.
Treviño and his sound recordist Henry Rangel spent the afternoon covering the marchers in the sun and then headed back to their car. They were parked near the entrance to a sheriff's substation.
And we were unloading the equipment into my car when all of a sudden we heard this incredible wailing of sirens and these cars started emerging from the parking lot. There must have been, I think I counted something like 35 different cars that whizzed by. And they were going so fast that we had to flatten ourselves up against the cars or else we would be hit. And in each of these sheriff's patrol cars, there were four or five or even six officers jammed in there with full riot gear.
Treviño found out later that someone at the Green Mill liquor store near the park had called the police to report a stolen six-pack of beer.
20 minutes earlier, And it had been a peaceful march. And I did the math. I said, well, how long does it take to get 35 cars full of sheriffs with their uniforms and everything else together and organized? And it was evident to me that they must have been waiting there for hours, perhaps. And I think when the call came in about the Green Mill liquor store, that was the pretext they were waiting for.
UCLA history professor Juan Gomez-Quinones wrote that 500 police officers and sheriff's deputies joined the melee that day. When it was all over, 400 people had been arrested, and four were dead.
Ruben Salazar was the only person who could speak with authority and credibility to both the Anglo and the Spanish-speaking population.
Felix Gutierrez is professor emeritus at USC Annenberg School of Journalism. He says Salazar played a pioneering role in Los Angeles journalism when he wrote for the almost entirely white Los Angeles Times.
So silencing his voice was a devastating move toward interracial understanding. And it showed that, you know, if you speak out or speak up too much, you might end up paying a price.
Salazar was killed as he sat at a table inside the Silver Dollar Cafe on Whittier Boulevard when L.A. County Sheriff's Deputy Tom Wilson fired a projectile through the doorway of the cafe that struck the reporter in the head. Gloria Arellano says the deaths of Lynn Ward, Angel Gilbert Diaz, Gustav Montag, and Ruben Salazar overshadowed the issues behind the moratorium.
Then, of course, what became the issue was the death of Ruben Salazar. He just went in there for a beer. And how does somebody shoot through a curtain and get him? He's sitting at a bar. That means they didn't announce. They just shot that canister in there.
In the days that followed, Jesus Trevino says people were outraged and furious.
Tempers were pretty high, and they were fearful that there was going to be another riot, that the community would explode again. And so the authorities all agreed that they should convene a blue ribbon panel made up of community members.
The county set up a coroner's inquest with members like clergy and community activists who could lend credibility to the investigation into Salazar's death. People like Irene Tovar, who currently sits on the City of LA's Human Relations Commission.
I guess to placate us, they created the inquest. And basically, it was most of us who had been the organizer. And our role was really nothing. We would go there every day, and then they would be interviewing the sheriffs and the LAPD. And our role was to sit there and observe.
So they went through the showcase coroner's inquest. It was a divided vote, as I understand. Then the district attorney, Evel J. Younger, decided not to file any charges.
The LA County Sheriff's Department historian declined to comment for this story on Ruben Salazar's death or the investigation that followed. Felix Gutierrez says a lot has changed since 1970, but there's still a long way to go.
We have more celebrities than we did 50 years ago, sports stars, politicians who play significant roles. But the day-to-day Latino events, I think, are still separated into problem people and zoo stories. We're either people who are beset or causing problems for others, or we're on display like in the zoo. We have to go beyond visibility to understanding, and we're not there yet.
The Chicano moratorium march propelled some who were there to create works of art and others to continue political activism, and many Mexican-American journalists to follow the path cut by Ruben Salazar. You can see one small piece of his legacy today in what used to be Laguna Park, now called Ruben Salazar Park. On a wall by a parking lot in the park, the Norteño band Los Tigres del Norte commissioned a mural by local artist Paul Botello. It shows themes of Chicano advancement and resistance and includes an image of Ruben Salazar himself. For KCRW, I'm Monica Lopez reporting from East Los Angeles.
¿Sabes, vida mía, por qué lloro? Porque te quiero, porque te adoro. ¿Sabes que nunca te he olvidado?
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. You know, Los Angeles used to be a part of Mexico. The United States took control of LA and California in 1847 during the Mexican-American War. But LA is still a city with a large Mexican-American population, a large Latino population, a city of 4 million people total, the nation's second largest, a county of 88 cities, which is complicated, and a gathering of boundaries and ideas. To anyone who comes for the first time, it's a hard place to get to know. In fact, even if you were born and raised in L.A., you can barely scratch the surface of this place. Writer D.J. Waldy is here to help. He spent a lifetime learning about and studying and writing about Greater L.A., good and bad. His latest book is a collection of essays and short pieces called Becoming Los Angeles, Myth, Memory, and a Sense of Place. And D.J. Waldy joins me right now. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you very much.
You live in Lakewood. In fact, you still live in the house where you were born. Lakewood lies between Compton and Long Beach, a place that many an Angeleno probably has driven past on the 605 or the 710, but perhaps never spent much time in. How do you see Lakewood in relation to the greater part of L.A.?
Lakewood is a fragment of a fractal city where many parts of it look very much the same. Lakewood is not an island within some kind of urban milieu. It is woven into the fabric of the entire Los Angeles County. I'm at a southeast corner of it, but I could be living almost anywhere in LA County.
What got you interested in really exploring and trying to get to know and understand Los Angeles in a way that few people take the time to?
Well, there were some wonderful writers from the recent past and from the more distant past that got me interested in local history. I think I have a fondness for finding out the backgrounds of things. But what really moved me to become a student of this place is a desire to be more connected to it. I have a heart and a brain made for connectedness. And that's how I have lived my life and made my writing work part of it.
I want you to read, DJ, a couple of lines from your book, if you wouldn't mind. The first part from the chapter on Eugene Plummer, the Californio. Would you mind reading that for us?
Los Angeles, more than any other city in the West, grabs you by the arm, nearly by the throat, and insists you hear another account of itself. For readers of its popular literature after 1900, Los Angeles must have seemed like a city of compulsive memoirists who want you to know why they came here, what they found when they did, and if they stayed or left.
First of all, DJ, would you give us a refresher on who or what a Californio is?
Californios self-defined themselves in the period, let's say, 1840 to 1860, as the born in Southern California sons and daughters of immigrants from Mexico. They themselves may have had mixed parentage, but they wanted to be distinct from the Native American population and definitely wanted to be distinct from the Anglo population that was leaking into Southern California around 1840.
And you say that L.A., more than any other city in the West, grabs you by the arm, nearly by the throat. How has the way L.A. has explained itself over the years to others, how has it changed over the years and decades and even centuries since it's been inhabited?
The great divide is the one that we're still in. Up until 1980, 1990, Los Angeles sold itself to the rest of the world, rest of America, as the best advertised lifestyle product in the world. A lot of that was made up of myths and beliefs and false historical narratives. Some would argue even false promises. Today's image of Los Angeles is sometimes very fearsome. There's a strongly dystopian or negative image of Los Angeles that is part of how we describe ourselves to each other. And I'm interested in not the mythology so much, or even the dystopic components of the story. I'm most interested in knowing how new narrators of Los Angeles stories, the new makers of the image of Los Angeles, what they are doing. And those new storytellers, new image makers, are as mixed and mingled in their colors and ethnicities and races as they can possibly be. Los Angeles has always been a crossroads of the world. Even back in the period of the Spanish and Mexican colonial periods. We really need to understand how netted into the world of commerce and migration Los Angeles always has been. And today we're becoming far more aware of that than ever before.
You talk a lot about architecture, too. It's a big interest of yours. The picture on the cover of your book is two cars parked in a carport in this mid-century modern house. You got the palm trees in the background. It's a very Southern California scene. You talk about driving around for hours on weekends with a friend just to look at all the buildings. It used to be a point of ridicule, but LA architecture is actually taken more seriously now, right?
Oh, absolutely. Our high architecture is much studied, but even our vernacular, our everyday architecture is important. The greatest artwork in Los Angeles, the most profound artwork in Los Angeles, is the architecture of its houses. Our homes are our finest artwork.
We know that LA is home to Tinseltown. It's home to, I mean, you talk about myth. I mean, it's make-believe. It's the land of make-believe, right? Does that factor into all of this?
But the biggest myth about Los Angeles is that it's Hollywood and that it's only Hollywood. And that's not true. Every Angeleno knows that Hollywood is only that part of Los Angeles that projects the romance and mystery and also noir aspect of Los Angeles to the world. But to ourselves, this is a complex, complicated place, just as you said, rich in diversity and in people and places and things, and teeming with stories that are not Hollywood stories, but are our stories, not the myths, but our actual lives. And that's what my book is partly about: how to read through Los Angeles to find the stories that are actually about us, not about some other place that we don't recognize.
What are some of your favorite stories? What are some of your favorite aspects of LA before we let you go?
I'm fascinated by the moment in California history when Latino culture and Anglo culture collided in the 1850s, 1860s, and early 1870s. And what came out of that? Some of it was tragic. Some of it was rather beautiful. And it still lives with us. That past is not completely gone in Southern California, in Los Angeles. And I'm interested, therefore, in the survivals of time in Los Angeles. When I look around in the built environment, when I see the buildings of the 18th and the adobe buildings of the 18th century, the classical buildings of the 19th century, the modernist buildings of the 20th century, I want to hear and see the conversation those structures are having with each other. And I'm really moved by the stories of people coming here. Why did they come here? What did they find when they got here? Why did they stay? Those stories I find are incredibly interesting.
We try and tell those stories all the time. DJ Waldie, whose latest book is Becoming Los Angeles, Myth, Memory, and a Sense of Place. DJ, as always, thanks for your time. Thanks for coming on today.
Very kind. Thank you, sir. Be well.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's probably a good bet that if you're like me, you kind of have an irrational fear of spiders. Now, arachnophobia is not only a fear, it was a blockbuster movie.
It's the perfect place.
Goodbye crime, goodbye grime.
Except for one pesky little problem.
Come with me and look at the web.
The web?
I have a
terrible fear of spiders. Come on, we live in the country now. It's time to work through this irrational, paralyzing terror.
Honey, we're in the living room. We need you to kill a spider.
With phobia aside, you've also heard that spiders are our friends. So let's talk about how our friends are doing here in Southern California. If you've lived in parts of Los Angeles long enough, you've probably come across a black widow or two. But maybe not recently, because black widows are disappearing from Southern California, replaced by the non-native brown widow. And so we were thinking, who do we talk to about spite? Oh yeah, Lila Higgins, Senior Manager for Community Science at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. She's a frequent guest, of course, here on Greater LA. Hi, Lila. Welcome back.
Hi, Steve.
T- tell us about the Brown Widow. When did people first start seeing the Brown Widow? Does it still have the hourglass on its body?
Yeah, it does. So it was first seen in 2003 in Torrance, and it was actually found by some elementary school students who were going around their yard and looking for spiders with a museum professional from my museum. And they do have hourglass. However, it is not red like the Black Widow. It is more of an orange color instead.
So brown and orange versus black and red.
At least for the adults, yes.
Okay. Where does it come from, this Brown Widow, and how did it get to Southern California? Did it take a flight?
We don't know exactly where they're from, but scientists have looked at the evolution, and we know that they evolved in Africa. The first time these spiders were described was actually in South America, though. And as with many introductions, we're not exactly sure how they got here. But, you know, we move around a lot of things, us humans, in shipping containers or on boats or in plants that we're bringing in for the nursery trade. Could have been any of those ways.
We know the Black Widows can be pretty venomous. They can be dangerous, right? Are Brown Widows the same? And do they act the same way?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people have this irrational fear of Black Widows, Brown Widows specifically, as opposed to other spiders. Some people just have, you know, that fear of all spiders. But venom is a very precious resource to spiders, and that's no different for the Black and Brown Widows. They've actually done some really interesting studies on widow spiders, and they really don't want to bite you. They even made fingers out of jello, researchers did, to squish and prod and poke. And you really do have to, like, pinch or squish the spider to elicit a bite response. And every time that a widow spider bites us does not mean that they always put venom in. So they can actually do what's called a dry bite. They have looked at the venom and differences between the Black and Brown Widow, and the venom is a little different. But again, it's potent, and you don't want to have a bad reaction to a venom, a Black or Brown Widow bite. But so it's such a rare occurrence. And a lot of people probably get bitten and don't even have a reaction. But we hear about the rare cases where people have a strong reaction. Those are the ones that get reported to doctors, and those are the ones that kind of end up in these medical reports.
All right, so we also know, apparently, that Black Widow numbers are going down. The Brown Widows are here. What's going on here? Is this like the Jets and the Sharks? Is this like a gang war? What's going on in Spiderville?
Yeah, so the project that we just started is called Widow Wars. And it is like this competition between the Black and the Brown Widows here in the LA area. And again, these Brown Widows showed up in 2003, and they are all over the place now. You'd actually be really hard-pressed to find a Black Widow in the LA area. I hardly ever see them, but I see Brown Widows all the time. Brown Widows are really good at making their homes, their webs, in so many different places. And Black Widows actually have, you know, they're a bit more discerning, and so they don't have as many places that they can build their webs, aka their homes, and so their numbers are just on the decrease for that reason alone. And you know, it's a shame, because again, the Black Widow is our native spider and the Brown Widow is an introduced spider. But they're really overtaking.
Where do you see these spiders, by the way? In the basement, you know, on a hike?
So generally I find Brown Widows in the out of doors. They very rarely move inside. They love being in lawn furniture, under the handles of trash cans. I've seen them in cinder block walls, you know, cracks and crevices like that. Black Widows I've seen a few times in actual garages, but again, not inside homes. But again, their webs are really, really, really specific. They have this really strong and really sticky silk. And so sometimes you'll not see the spider, but you'll feel that silk. And it like really is like almost tugging on you as you walk past it or feel it on your ankle or on your arm. And you're like,
Wow. That's the worst feeling, by the way, Leela Higgins, when you walk into a spider web and we've all done it. And you're like, oh, no, is there, you know, is he or she home?
Right. And I think that, you know, the brown and black widows, again, they are not, it's not like they're stringing their webs across between trees like the big orb weavers do, like with the Charlotte's web kind of web. They're more on the sides of, you know, walls or, again, in these handles of trash cans. And they are so adept at making these webs to catch prey that is like walking along or crawling along the ground. And then they get snared in this web that they have perfectly designed for that function.
So for your research, Leela, and the museum for which you work, what are you asking folks to do? Take pictures? What can everyday folks do to help you research more about this?
Yeah, so as a part of our community science program, we try to make it really easy for folks to get us the information that we're looking for. And also, hopefully, they can learn something at the same time. So if you see a widow web in your yard or in your local park, snap a picture of it and then go back and check it over the next couple weeks and see what kind of prey items are in that web. Because literally, these widows, black and brown, can eat things like baby lizards, snakes. I said that. They can predate on snakes. Rodents, small birds, beetles, insects. I think a lot of people are like, of course, spiders eat insects and you find insects in their web. But I think what surprises people is the fact that vertebrates, things with a backbone, like the lizards and the snake and the birds and the small rodents, I think that does surprise people. And so we want to find out, because there are so many brown widows now, are they disproportionately affecting native species by predating on them? Because there's so many more now. That's what we want to know. And so take those pictures, send them into the museum. You can upload them directly to the app iNaturalist, which is a free app. Or you can email us at nature@nhm.org. And we'll upload it for you.
All right. We'll have a link, by the way, a little bit later on the website, too. So check out our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Leela Higgins, Senior Manager for Community Science over the Natural History Museum of LA County. Leela, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Before we go, though, KCRW has teamed up with stations all across the state today in celebration of, can you believe it, the inaugural California Public Radio Day, an official day to show your love for nonprofit public radio. So naturally, we've got a challenge grant in place to help you along, to entice you. Today only, your gift doubled up to $10,000. Thanks to the generosity of KCRW champion, our friend Julie Burton. Thank you, Julie, for your support of public radio as well. Check out kcrw.com/give, and thank you for your support of public radio. While you're there, subscribe to the podcast too, would you? At kcrw.com/greaterLA. We're glad you joined us today. Jenna Cagle, Kaylee Wells, Sonia Geis, Amy Tom, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Kat Ewer, Jody Adler, Mike Newport, Christian Bordahl, Ray Guarna, all made this show happen today. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for your ears. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great day.